"Then am I to order those large sterlets?" asked the steward. "Yes, it can't be helped if they won't take less. Oh, dear me, I was forgetting. We must have another entree. Oh, goodness gracious," he clutched at his head. "Who is going to get me the flowers? Dmitri, hey, Dmitri, gallop off to our Moscow estate," he said to the factotum who appeared at his call. "Hurry off and tell Maxime the gardener to set the serfs to work. Say that everything out of the hothouses must be brought here well wrapped up in felt. I must have 200 pots here on Friday." Having given several more orders, he was about to go to his little countess to have a rest, but remembering something else of importance, he again returned, called back the cook and the club steward, and again began giving orders. A light footstep and the clinking of spurs were heard at the door, and the young count, handsome, rosy, with a dark little moustache, evidently rested and made sleeker by his easy life in Moscow, entered the room. "Ah, my dear boy, my head's in a whirl," said the old man with a smile, as if he felt a little confused before his son. "Now, if you would only help a bit. I must have singers, too. I shall have my own orchestra, but shouldn't we get the gypsy singers as well? You military men like that sort of thing." "Really, Papa, I believe Prince Bagration worried himself less before the Battle of Schöngraben than you do now," said his son with a smile. The old count pretended to be angry. "Yes, you talk, but try it yourself." And the count turned to the cook, who, with a shrewd and respectful expression, looked observantly and sympathetically at the father and son. "What have the young people come to nowadays, eh, Feoktist?" said he, "laughing at us old fellows." "That's so, Your Excellency. All they have to do is to eat a good dinner, but providing it and serving it up, that's not their business."
"That's it, that's it!" exclaimed the count, and gaily seizing his son by both hands, he cried, "Now I've got you, so take the sleigh and pair at once, and go to Bezukhov's and tell him Count Ilya has sent you to ask for strawberries and fresh pineapples. We can't get them from anyone else. He's not there himself, so you'll have to go in and ask the princesses, and from there go on to the Razgulyai, the coachman Ipatka knows, and look up the gypsy Ilyushka, the one who danced at Count Orlov's, you remember, in a white Cossack coat, and bring him along to me."
"And am I to bring the gypsy girls along with him?" asked Nikolai, laughing. "Dear, dear."
At that moment, with noiseless footsteps, and with the businesslike, preoccupied, yet meekly Christian look which never left her face, Anna Mikhailovna entered the hall. Though she came upon the count in his dressing-gown every day, he invariably became confused and begged her to excuse his costume.
"No matter at all, my dear count," she said, meekly closing her eyes. "But I'll go to Bezukhov's myself. Pierre has arrived, and now we shall get anything we want from his hothouses. I have to see him in any case. He has forwarded me a letter from Boris. Thank God, Boris is now on the staff."
The count was delighted at Anna Mikhailovna's taking upon herself one of his commissions, and ordered the small closed carriage for her.
"Tell Bezukhov to come. I'll put his name down. Is his wife with him?" he asked.
Anna Mikhailovna turned up her eyes, and profound sadness was depicted on her face.
"Ah, my dear friend, he is very unfortunate," she said. "If what we hear is true, it is dreadful. How little we dreamed of such a thing when we were rejoicing at his happiness. And such a lofty, angelic soul as young Bezukhov. Yes, I pity him from my heart, and shall try to give him what consolation I can."
"What is the matter?" asked both the young and old Rostov. Anna Mikhailovna sighed deeply.
"Dolohov, Maria Ivanovna's son," she said in a mysterious whisper, "has compromised her completely, they say. Pierre took him up, invited him to his house in Petersburg, and now she has come here and that daredevil after her," said Anna Mikhailovna, wishing to show her sympathy for Pierre, but by involuntary intonations and a half-smile betraying her sympathy for the daredevil, as she called Dolohov. "They say Pierre is quite broken by his misfortune."
"Dear, dear! But still, tell him to come to the club. It'll all blow over. It'll be a tremendous banquet."
Next day, the 3rd of March, soon after 1 o'clock, 250 members of the English club and 50 guests were awaiting the guest of honour and hero of the Austrian campaign, Prince Bagration, to dinner. On the first arrival of the news of the Battle of Austerlitz, Moscow had been bewildered. At that time, the Russians were so used to victories that on receiving news of the defeat, some would simply not believe it, while others sought some extraordinary explanation of so strange an event. In the English club, where all who were distinguished, important, and well-informed foregathered when the news began to arrive in December, nothing was said about the war and the last battle, as though all were in a conspiracy of silence. The men who set the tone in conversation, Count Rostopchin, Prince Yuri Dolgorukov, Valuev, Count Markov, and Prince Vyazemsky, did not show themselves at the club, but met in private houses, in intimate circles, and the Muscovites who took their opinions from others, Ilya Rostov among them, remained for a while without any definite opinion on the subject of the war and without leaders. The Muscovites felt that something was wrong and that to discuss the bad news was difficult, and so it was best to be silent. But after a while, just as a jury comes out of its room, the bigwigs who guided the club's opinion reappeared, and everybody began speaking clearly and definitely. Reasons were found for the incredible, unheard-of, and impossible event of a Russian defeat. Everything became clear, and in all corners of Moscow the same things began to be said. These reasons were the treachery of the Austrians, a defective commissariat, the treachery of the Pole, Przebyszewski, and of the Frenchman Longeron, Kutuzov's incapacity, and, it was whispered, the youth and inexperience of the sovereign, who had trusted worthless and insignificant people. But the army, the Russian army, everyone declared, was extraordinary and had achieved miracles of valour. The soldiers, officers, and generals were heroes. But the hero of heroes was Prince Bagration, distinguished by his Schöngraben affair and by the retreat from Austerlitz, where he alone had withdrawn his column unbroken and had all day beaten back an enemy force twice as numerous as his own. What also conduced to Bagration's being selected as Moscow's hero was the fact that he had no connections in that city and was a stranger there. In his person, honour was shown to a simple, fighting Russian soldier without connections and intrigues, and to one who was associated by memories of the Italian campaign with the name of Suvorov. Moreover, paying such honour to Bagration was the best way of expressing disapproval and dislike of Kutuzov.
"Had there been no Bagration, it would have been necessary to invent him," said the wit Shinshin, parodying the words of Voltaire.
Kutuzov no one spoke of, except some who abused him in whispers, calling him a court weathercock and an old satyr. All Moscow repeated Prince Dolgorukov saying, "If you go on modelling and modelling, you must get smeared with clay," suggesting consolation for our defeat by the memory of former victories. And the words of Rostopchin, that French soldiers have to be incited to battle by highfalutin words, and Germans by logical arguments to show them that it is more dangerous to run away than to advance, but that Russian soldiers only need to be restrained and held back. On all sides, new and fresh anecdotes were heard of individual examples of heroism shown by our officers and men at Austerlitz. One had saved a standard, another had killed 5 Frenchmen, a third had loaded 5 cannons single-handed. Berg was mentioned, by those who did not know him, as having, when wounded in the right hand, taken his sword in the left and gone forward. Of Bolkonski, nothing was said, and only those who knew him intimately regretted that he had died so young, leaving a pregnant wife with his eccentric father. Chapter 3. Bagration as Guest of Honour. On that 3rd of March, all the rooms in the English club were filled with a hum of conversation, like the hum of bees swarming in springtime. The members and guests of the club wandered hither and thither, sat, stood, met, and separated, some in uniform and some in evening dress, and a few here and there with powdered hair and in Russian kaftans. powdered footmen in livery with buckled shoes and smart stockings stood at every door, anxiously noting visitors' every movement in order to offer their services. Most of those present were elderly, respected men, with broad, self-confident faces, fat fingers, and resolute gestures and voices. This class of guests and members sat in certain habitual places and met in certain habitual groups. A minority of those present were casual guests, chiefly young men, among whom were Denisov, Rostov, and Dolokhov, who was now again an officer in the Semyonov regiment. The faces of these young people, especially those who were military men, bore that expression of condescending respect for their elders, which seemed to say to the older generation, "We are prepared to respect and honour you, but all the same, remember that the future belongs to us." Nesvitsky was there as an old member of the club. Pierre, who at his wife's command had let his hair grow and abandoned his spectacles, went about the rooms fashionably dressed, but looking sad and dull. Here, as elsewhere, he was surrounded by an atmosphere of subservience to his wealth, and being in the habit of lording it over these people, he treated them with absent-minded contempt. By his age he should have belonged to the younger men, but by his wealth and connections he belonged to the groups of old and honoured guests, and so he went from one group to another. Some of the most important old men were the centre of groups which even strangers approached respectfully to hear the voices of well-known men. The largest circles formed round Count Rostopchin, Valuev, and Narishkin. Rostopchin was describing how the Russians had been overwhelmed by fleeing Austrians and had had to force their way through them with bayonets. Valuev was confidentially telling that Uvarov had been sent from Petersburg to ascertain what Moscow was thinking about Austerlitz. In the third circle, Narishkin was speaking of the meeting of the Austrian Council of War, at which Suvorov crowed like a cock in reply to the nonsense talked by the Austrian generals. Shinshin, standing close by, tried to make a joke, saying that Kutuzov had evidently failed to learn from Suvorov even so simple a thing as the art of crowing like a cock. But the elder members glanced severely at the wit, making him feel that in that place and on that day it was improper to speak so of Kutuzov. Count Ilya Rostov, hurried and preoccupied, went about in his soft boots between the dining and drawing rooms, hastily greeting the important and unimportant, all of whom he knew, as if they were all equals, while his eyes occasionally sought out his fine, well-set-up young son, resting on him and winking joyfully at him. Young Rostov stood at a window with Dolokhov, whose acquaintance he had lately made and highly valued. The old count came up to them and pressed Dolokhov's hand.
"Please come and visit us. You know my brave boy. Been together out there, both playing the hero. Ah, Vasily Ignatovich, how do you do, old fellow?" he said, turning to an old man who was passing.
But before he had finished his greeting, there was a general stir, and a footman who had run in announced, with a frightened face, "He's arrived." Bells rang, the stewards rushed forward, and like rye shaken together in a shovel, the guests who had been scattered about in different rooms came together and crowded in the large drawing-room by the door of the ballroom. Bagration appeared in the doorway of the anteroom, without hat or sword, which, in accord with the club custom, he had given up to the hall-porter. He had no lambskin cap on his head, nor had he a loaded whip over his shoulder, as when Rostov had seen him on the eve of the Battle of Austerlitz, but wore a tight new uniform with Russian and foreign orders and the Star of St. George on his left breast. Evidently just before coming to the dinner, he had had his hair and whiskers trimmed, which changed his appearance for the worse. There was something naively festive in his air, which, in conjunction with his firm and virile features, gave him a rather comical expression. Bekleshov and Theodore Uvarov, who had arrived with him, paused at the doorway to allow him, as the guest of honour, to enter first. Bagration was embarrassed, not wishing to avail himself of their courtesy, and this caused some delay at the doors, but after all he did at last enter first. He walked shyly and awkwardly over the parquet floor of the reception room, not knowing what to do with his hands. He was more accustomed to walk over a ploughed field under fire, as he had done at the head of the Kursk regiment at Schöngraben, and he would have found that easier. The committee men met him at the first door, and expressing their delight at seeing such a highly honoured guest, took possession of him, as it were, without waiting for his reply, surrounded him, and led him to the drawing-room. It was at first impossible to enter the drawing-room door for the crowd of members and guests jostling one another and trying to get a good look at Bagration over each other's shoulders, as if he were some rare animal. Count Ilya Rostov, laughing and repeating the words, "Make way, dear boy, make way, make way," pushed through the crowd more energetically than anyone, led the guests into the drawing-room and seated them on the centre sofa. The bigwigs, the most respected members of the club, beset the new arrivals. Count Ilya, again thrusting his way through the crowd, went out of the drawing-room and reappeared a minute later with another committee man carrying a large silver salver, which he presented to Prince Bagration. On the salver lay some verses composed and printed in the hero's honour. Bagration, on seeing the salver, glanced round in dismay as though seeking help, but all eyes demanded that he should submit. Feeling himself in their power, he resolutely took the salver with both hands and looked sternly and reproachfully at the count who had presented it to him. Someone obligingly took the dish from Bagration, or he would, it seemed, have held it till evening and have gone into dinner with it, and drew his attention to the verses. "Well, I will read them, then," Bagration seemed to say, and, fixing his weary eyes on the paper, began to read them with a fixed and serious expression. But the author himself took the verses and began reading them aloud. Bagration bowed his head and listened. "Bring glory, then, to Alexander's reign, and on the throne our Titus shield. A dreaded foe be thou, kind-hearted as a man, a Ripheus at home, a Caesar in the field. E'en fortunate Napoleon knows by experience now Bagration, and dare not Herculean Russians trouble." But before he had finished reading, a stentorian major domo announced that dinner was ready. The door opened, and from the dining-room came the resounding strains of the Polonaise. "Conquest's joyful thunder waken! Triumph, valiant Russians, now!" And Count Rostov, glancing angrily at the author who went on reading his verses, bowed to Bagration. Everyone rose, feeling that dinner was more important than verses, and Bagration, again preceding all the rest, went in to dinner. He was seated in the place of honour between two Alexanders, Bekleshov and Naryshkin, which was a significant allusion to the name of the sovereign. 300 persons took their seats in the dining-room, according to their rank and importance, the more important nearer to the honoured guest, as naturally as water flows deepest where the land lies lowest. Just before dinner, Count Ilya Rostov presented his son to Bagration, who recognised him and said a few words to him, disjointed and awkward, as were all the words he spoke that day, and Count Ilya looked joyfully and proudly around while Bagration spoke to his son. Nikolai Rostov, with Denisov and his new acquaintance Dolokhov, sat almost at the middle of the table. Facing them sat Pierre, beside Prince Nesvitsky. Count Ilya Rostov, with the other members of the committee, sat facing Bagration, and as the very personification of Moscow hospitality, did the honours to the prince. His efforts had not been in vain. The dinner, both the Lenten and the other fare, was splendid. Yet he could not feel quite at ease till the end of the meal. He winked at the butler, whispered directions to the footman, and awaited each expected dish with some anxiety. Everything was excellent. With the second course, a gigantic sterlet, at the sight of which Ilya Rostov blushed with self-conscious pleasure, the footman began popping corks and filling the champagne glasses. After the fish, which made a certain sensation, the count exchanged glances with the other committee men. "There will be many toasts. It's time to begin," he whispered, and taking up his glass, he rose. All were silent, waiting for what he would say. "To the health of our sovereign, the Emperor!" he cried, and at the same moment his kindly eyes grew moist with tears of joy and enthusiasm. The band immediately struck up Conquest's joyful Thunder Waken. All rose and cried, "Hurrah!" Bagration also rose and shouted, "Hurrah!" in exactly the same voice in which he had shouted it on the field at Schöngraben. Young Rostov's ecstatic voice could be heard above the 300 others. He nearly wept. "To the health of our sovereign, the Emperor!" he roared. "Hurrah!" And emptying his glass at one gulp, he dashed it on the floor. Many followed his example, and the loud shouting continued for a long time. When the voices subsided, the footmen cleared away the broken glass, and everybody sat down again, smiling at the noise they had made and exchanging remarks. The old count rose once more, glanced at a note lying beside his plate, and proposed a toast. "To the health of the hero of our last campaign, Prince Pyotr Ivanovich Bagration!" And again his blue eyes grew moist. "Hurrah!" cried the 300 voices again, but instead of the band, a choir began singing a cantata composed by Paul Ivanovich Kutuzov. "Russians o'er all barriers on! Courage conquest guarantees! Have we not Bagration? He brings foes to their knees!" As soon as the singing was over, another and another toast was proposed, and Count Ilya Rostov became more and more moved. More glass was smashed, and the shouting grew louder. They drank to Bekleshev, Narishkin, Uvarov, Dolgorukov, Apraksin, Valuev, to the committee, to all the club members and to all the club guests, and finally to Count Ilya Rostov separately, as the organizer of the banquet. At that toast, the count took out his handkerchief and, covering his face, wept outright. Chapter 4. Pierre challenges Dolokhov. Pierre sat opposite Dolokhov and Nikolai Rostov. As usual, he ate and drank much and eagerly, but those who knew him intimately noticed that some great change had come over him that day. He was silent all through dinner and looked about, blinking and scowling, or with fixed eyes and a look of complete absent-mindedness, kept rubbing the bridge of his nose. His face was depressed and gloomy. He seemed to see and hear nothing of what was going on around him, and to be absorbed by some depressing and unsolved problem. The unsolved problem that tormented him was caused by hints given by the princess, his cousin, at Moscow, concerning Dolokhov's intimacy with his wife, and by an anonymous letter he had received that morning, which, in the mean, jocular way common to anonymous letters, said that he saw badly through his spectacles, but that his wife's connection with Dolokhov was a secret to no one but himself. Pierre absolutely disbelieved both the princess's hints and the letter, but he feared now to look at Dolokhov, who was sitting opposite him. Every time he chanced to meet Dolokhov's handsome, insolent eyes, Pierre felt something terrible and monstrous rising in his soul and turned quickly away. Involuntarily recalling his wife's past and her relations with Dolokhov, Pierre saw clearly that what was said in the letter might be true, or might at least seem to be true, had it not referred to his wife. He involuntarily remembered how Dolokhov, who had fully recovered his former position after the campaign, had returned to Petersburg and had come to him. Availing himself of his friendly relations with Pierre as a boon companion, Dolokhov had come straight to his house, and Pierre had put him up and lent him money. Pierre recalled how Hélène had smilingly expressed disapproval of Dolokhov's living at the house, and how cynically Dolokhov had praised his wife's beauty to him, and from that time till they came to Moscow had not left them for a day. "Yes, he is very handsome," thought Pierre, "and I know him. It would be particularly pleasant to him to dishonour my name and ridicule me just because I have exerted myself on his behalf, befriended him and helped him, I know and understand what a spice that would add to the pleasure of deceiving me, if it really were true. Yes, if it were true, but I do not believe it. I have no right to, and can't believe it. He remembered the expression Dolokhov's face assumed in his moments of cruelty, as when tying the policeman to the bear and dropping them into the water, or when he challenged a man to a duel without any reason, or shot a postboy's horse with a pistol. That expression was often on Dolokhov's face when looking at him. Yes, he is a bully, thought Pierre. To kill a man means nothing to him. It must seem to him that everyone is afraid of him, and that must please him. He must think that I, too, am afraid of him. And in fact, I am afraid of him, he thought. And again he felt something terrible and monstrous rising in his soul. Dolokhov, Denisov, and Rostov were now sitting opposite Pierre, and seemed very gay. Rostov was talking merrily to his two friends, one of whom was a dashing hussar and the other a notorious duelist and rake, and every now and then he glanced ironically at Pierre, whose preoccupied, absent-minded, and massive figure was a very noticeable one at the dinner. Rostov looked inimically at Pierre, first because Pierre appeared to his hussar eyes as a rich civilian, the husband of a beauty, and in a word, an old woman, and secondly because Pierre, in his preoccupation and absent-mindedness, had not recognized Rostov and had not responded to his greeting. When the Emperor's health was drunk, Pierre, lost in thought, did not rise or lift his glass.
"What are you about?"
shouted Rostov, looking at him in an ecstasy of exasperation.
"Don't you hear it's His Majesty the Emperor's health?"
Pierre sighed, rose submissively, emptied his glass, and waiting till all were seated again, turned with his kindly smile to Rostov.
"Why, I didn't recognize you," he said.
But Rostov was otherwise engaged. He was shouting,
"Hurrah!"
"Why don't you renew the acquaintance?" said Dolokhov to Rostov.
"Confound him, he's a fool," said Rostov. "One should make up to the husbands of pretty women," said Denisov.
Pierre did not catch what they were saying, but knew they were talking about him. He reddened and turned away.
"Well, now to the health of handsome women," said Dolokhov, and with a serious expression, but with a smile lurking at the corners of his mouth, he turned with his glass to Pierre. "Here's to the health of lovely women, Peterkin, and their lovers," he added.
Pierre, with downcast eyes, drank out of his glass without looking at Dolokhov or answering him. The footman, who was distributing leaflets with Kutuzov's cantata, laid one before Pierre as one of the principal guests. He was just going to take it when Dolokhov, leaning across, snatched it from his hand and began reading it. Pierre looked at Dolokhov and his eyes dropped. The something terrible and monstrous that had tormented him all dinner time rose and took possession of him. He leaned his whole massive body across the table.
"How dare you take it?"
he shouted. Hearing that cry and seeing to whom it was addressed, Nesvitsky and the neighbour on his right quickly turned in alarm to Bezukhov.
"Don't, don't! What are you about?" whispered their frightened voices.
Dolokhov looked at Pierre with clear, mirthful, cruel eyes, and that smile of his which seemed to say,
"Ah, this is what I like." "You shan't have it," he said distinctly.
Pale, with quivering lips, Pierre snatched the copy.
You scoundrel! I challenge you!" he cried,
and pushing back his chair, he rose from the table. At the very instant he did this and uttered those words, Pierre felt that the question of his wife's guilt, which had been tormenting him the whole day, was finally and indubitably answered in the affirmative. He hated her, and was forever sundered from her. Despite Denisov's request that he would take no part in the matter, Rostov agreed to be Dolokhov's second, and after dinner he discussed the arrangements for the duel with Nesvitsky, Bezukhov's second. Pierre went home, but Rostov, with Dolokhov and Denisov, stayed on at the club till late, listening to the gypsies and other singers.
"Well then, till tomorrow at Sokolniki,"
said Dolokhov as he took leave of Rostov in the club porch.
And do you feel quite calm?
Rostov asked. Dolokhov paused.
Well, you see, I'll tell you the whole secret of duelling in two words. If you're going to fight a duel, and you make a will and write affectionate letters to your parents, and if you think you may be killed, you're a fool and are lost for certain. But go with the firm intention of killing your man as quickly and surely as possible, and then all will be right, as our bear huntsman at Kostromar used to tell me. Everyone fears a bear, he says, but when you see one, your fear's all gone, and your only thought is not to let him get away. And that's how it is with me. À demain, mon cher.
Next day, at 8 in the morning, Pierre and Nesvitsky drove to the Sokolniki forest and found Dolokhov, Denisov and Rostov already there. Pierre had the air of a man preoccupied with considerations which had no connection with the matter in hand. His haggard face was yellow. He had evidently not slept that night. He looked about distractedly and screwed up his eyes as if dazzled by the sun. He was entirely absorbed by two considerations: his wife's guilt, of which after his sleepless night he had not the slightest doubt, and the guiltlessness of Dolokhov, who had no reason to preserve the honour of a man who was nothing to him.
"I should perhaps have done the same thing in his place," thought Pierre. "It's even certain that I should have done the same. Then why this duel, this murder? Either I shall kill him, or he will hit me in the head, or elbow, or knee. Can't I go away from here, run away, bury myself somewhere?" passed through his mind.
But just at moments when such thoughts occurred to him, he would ask in a particularly calm and absent-minded way, which inspired the respect of the onlookers, "Will it be long? Are things ready?" When all was ready, the sabres stuck in the snow to mark the barriers, and the pistols loaded, Nesvitsky went up to Pierre.
"I should not be doing my duty, Count," he said in timid tones, "and should not justify your confidence and the honour you have done me in choosing me for your second, if at this grave, this very grave moment, I did not tell you the whole truth. I think there is no sufficient ground for this affair, or for blood to be shed over it. You were not right, not quite in the right. You were impetuous."
"Oh, yes, it is horribly stupid," said Pierre.
"Then allow me to express your regrets, and I am sure your opponent will accept them," said Nesvitsky, who, like the others concerned in the affair, and like everyone in similar cases, did not yet believe that the affair had come to an actual duel. "You know, Count, it is much more honourable to admit one's mistake than to let matters become irreparable. There was no insult on either side. Allow me to convey..."
"No! What is there to talk about?" said Pierre. "It's all the same. Is everything ready?" he added.
"Only tell me where to go and where to shoot," he said with an unnaturally gentle smile.
He took the pistol in his hand and began asking about the working of the trigger, as he had not before held a pistol in his hand, a fact that he did not wish to confess.
"Oh, yes, like that. I know. I only forgot," said he.
"No apologies. None whatever," said Dolokhov to Denisov, who on his side had been attempting a reconciliation. And he also went up to the appointed place. The spot chosen for the duel was some 80 paces from the road, where the sleighs had been left, in a small clearing in the pine forest, covered with melting snow, the frost having begun to break up during the last few days. The antagonists stood 40 paces apart at the farther edge of the clearing. The seconds, measuring the paces, left tracks in the deep, wet snow between the place where they had been standing and Nesvitsky's and Dolokhov's sabres, which were stuck into the ground 10 paces apart to mark the barrier. It was thawing and misty. At 40 paces distance, nothing could be seen. For 3 minutes, all had been ready, but they still delayed, and all were silent.
Chapter 5. the duel.
"Well, begin," said Dolokhov.
"All right," said Pierre, still smiling in the same way. A feeling of dread was in the air. It was evident that the affair so lightly begun could no longer be averted, but was taking its course independently of men's will. Denisov first went to the barrier and announced,
"As the adversaries have refused a reconciliation, please proceed. Take your pistols, and at the word three, begin to advance. One, two, three," he shouted angrily and stepped aside.
The combatants advanced along the trodden tracks, nearer and nearer to one another, beginning to see one another through the mist. They had the right to fire when they liked as they approached the barrier. Dolokhov walked slowly without raising his pistol, looking intently with his bright, sparkling blue eyes into his antagonist's face. His mouth wore its usual semblance of a smile.
"So, I can fire when I like," said Pierre. And at the word three, he went quickly forward, missing the trodden path and stepping into the deep snow. He held the pistol in his right hand at arm's length, apparently afraid of shooting himself with it. His left hand he held carefully back, because he wished to support his right hand with it and knew he must not do so. Having advanced 6 paces and strayed off the track into the snow, Pierre looked down at his feet, then quickly glanced at Dolokhov, and bending his finger, as he had been shown, fired. Not at all expecting so loud a report, Pierre shuddered at the sound, and then, smiling at his own sensations, stood still. The smoke, rendered denser by the mist, prevented him from seeing anything for an instant, but there was no second report as he had expected. He only heard Dolokhov's hurried steps, and his figure came in view through the smoke. He was pressing one hand to his left side, while the other clutched his drooping pistol. His face was pale. Rostov ran toward him and said something.
"No," muttered Dolokhov through his teeth. "No, it's not over."
And after stumbling a few staggering steps right up to the sabre, he sank on the snow beside it. His left hand was bloody. He wiped it on his coat and supported himself with it. His frowning face was pallid and quivered.
"Please," began Dolokhov, but could not at first pronounce the word. "Please," he uttered with an effort.
Pierre, hardly restraining his sobs, began running toward Dolokhov and was about to cross the space between the barriers when Dolokhov cried,
"Do your barrier!"
And Pierre, grasping what was meant, stopped by his sabre. Only 10 paces divided them. Dolokhov lowered his head to the snow, greedily bit at it, again raised his head, adjusted himself, drew in his legs and sat up, seeking a firm centre of gravity. He sucked and swallowed the cold snow, his lips quivered, but his eyes, still smiling, glittered with effort and exasperation as he mustered his remaining strength. He raised his pistol and aimed.
"Sideways! Cover yourself with your pistol!"
shouted Nesvitsky.
"Cover yourself!"
even Denisov cried to his adversary. Pierre, with a gentle smile of pity and remorse, his arms and legs helplessly spread out, stood with his broad chest directly facing Dolokhov and looked sorrowfully at him. Denisov, Rostov and Nesvitsky closed their eyes. At the same instant they heard a report and Dolokhov's angry cry.
"Missed!"
shouted Dolokhov, and he lay helplessly, face downwards on the snow. Pierre clutched his temples and, turning round, went into the forest, trampling through the deep snow and muttering incoherent words.
"Folly, folly, death lies," he repeated, puckering his face.
Nesvitsky stopped him and took him home. Rostov and Denisov drove away with the wounded Dolokhov. The latter lay silent in the sleigh with closed eyes and did not answer a word to the questions addressed to him. But on entering Moscow he suddenly came to and, lifting his head with an effort, took Rostov, who was sitting beside him, by the hand. Rostov was struck by the totally altered and unexpectedly rapturous and tender expression on Dolokhov's face.
"Well, how do you feel?" he asked.
"Bad. But it's not that, my friend," said Dolokhov with a gasping voice.
"Where are we?" "In Moscow, I know. I don't matter. But I have killed her. Killed. She won't get over it. She won't survive."
"Who?" asked Rostov.
"My mother. My mother, my angel, my adored angel mother."
And Dolokhov pressed Rostov's hand and burst into tears. When he had become a little quieter, he explained to Rostov that he was living with his mother, who, if she saw him dying, would not survive it. He implored Rostov to go on and prepare her. Rostov went on ahead to do what was asked, and to his great surprise learned that Dolokhov, the brawler, Dolokhov the bully, lived in Moscow with an old mother and a hunchback sister, and was the most affectionate of sons and brothers. Chapter 6. Pierre and Hélène. Pierre had of late rarely seen his wife alone. Both in Petersburg and in Moscow, their house was always full of visitors. The night after the duel, he did not go to his bedroom, but, as he often did, remained in his father's room, that huge room in which Count Bezukhov had died. He lay down on the sofa, meaning to fall asleep and forget all that had happened to him, but could not do so. Such a storm of feelings, thoughts, and memories suddenly arose within him that he could not fall asleep, nor even remain in one place, but had to jump up and pace the room with rapid steps. Now he seemed to see her in the early days of their marriage, with bare shoulders and a languid, passionate look on her face, and then immediately he saw beside her Dolokhov's handsome, insolent, hard and mocking face, as he had seen it at the banquet, and then that same face, pale, quivering and suffering, as it had been when he reeled and sank on the snow. "What has happened?" he asked himself. "I have killed her lover, yes. Killed my wife's lover, yes, that was it. And why? How did I come to it?"
"Because you married her," answered an inner voice.
"But in what was I to blame?" he asked. "In marrying her without loving her, in deceiving yourself and her." And he vividly recalled that moment after supper at Prince Vasily's, when he spoke those words he had found so difficult to utter. "I love you." "It all comes from that. Even then I felt it," he thought. "I felt then that it was not so, that I had no right to do it. And so it turns out." He remembered his honeymoon and blushed at the recollection. Particularly vivid, humiliating, and shameful was the recollection of how one day, soon after his marriage, he came out of the bedroom into his study a little before noon in his silk dressing gown and found his head steward there, who, bowing respectfully, looked into his face and at his dressing gown and smiled slightly, as if expressing respectful understanding of his employer's happiness. "But how often I have felt proud of her majestic beauty and social tact," thought he. "Been proud of my house, in which she received all Petersburg, proud of her unapproachability and beauty. So this is what I was proud of. I then thought that I did not understand her. How often, when considering her character, I have told myself that I was to blame for not understanding her, for not understanding that constant composure and complacency and lack of all interests or desires, and the whole secret lies in the terrible truth that she is a depraved woman. Now I have spoken that terrible word to myself, all has become clear. Anatole used to come to borrow money from her, and used to kiss her naked shoulders. She did not give him the money, but let herself be kissed. Her father in jest tried to rouse her jealousy, and she replied with a calm smile that she was not so stupid as to be jealous. 'Let him do what he pleases,' she used to say of me. One day I asked her if she felt any symptoms of pregnancy. She laughed contemptuously and said she was not a fool to want to have children, and that she was not going to have any children by me. Then he recalled the coarseness and bluntness of her thoughts and the vulgarity of the expressions that were natural to her, though she had been brought up in the most aristocratic circles.
"I'm not such a fool. Just you try it on. Allez-vous promener," she used to say. Often seeing the success she had with young and old men and women, Pierre could not understand why he did not love her. "Yes, I never loved her," said he to himself. "I knew she was a depraved woman," he repeated, "but dared not admit it to myself. And now there's Dolokhov sitting in the snow with a forced smile, and perhaps dying, while meeting my remorse with some forced bravado." Pierre was one of those people who, in spite of an appearance of what is called weak character, do not seek a confidant in their troubles. He digested his sufferings alone. "It is all her fault," he said to himself. "But what of that? Why did I bind myself to her? Why did I say, 'Je vous aime,' to her, which was a lie, and worse than a lie? I am guilty, and must endure, what, a slur on my name? A misfortune for life? Oh, that's nonsense," he thought. "The slur on my name and honour, that's all apart from myself. Louis XVI was executed because they said he was dishonourable and a criminal," came into Pierre's head, "and from their point of view they were right, as were those two who canonized him and died a martyr's death for his sake. Then Robespierre was beheaded for being a despot. Who is right and who is wrong? No one. But if you are alive, live. Tomorrow you'll die, as I might have died an hour ago. And is it worth tormenting oneself, when one has only a moment of life in comparison with eternity?"
But at the moment when he imagined himself calmed by such reflections, she suddenly came into his mind, as she was at the moments when he had most strongly expressed his insincere love for her, and he felt the blood rush to his heart, and had again to get up and move about and break and tear whatever came to his hand. "Why did I tell her that, je vous aime?" he kept repeating to himself. And when he had said it for the tenth time, Molière's words, "Mais que diable allait-il faire dans cette galère?" occurred to him. But what the devil was he doing in that mess? And he began to laugh at himself. In the night he called his valet and told him to pack up to go to Petersburg. He could not imagine how he could speak to her now. He resolved to go away next day and leave a letter informing her of his intention to part from her for ever. Next morning, when the valet came into the room with his coffee, Pierre was lying asleep on the ottoman with an open book in his hand. He woke up and looked round for a while with a startled expression, unable to realize where he was. "The Countess told me to inquire whether Your Excellency was at home," said the valet. But before Pierre could decide what answer he would send, the Countess herself, in a white satin dressing gown embroidered with silver and with simply dressed hair, two immense plaits twice round her lovely head like a coronet, entered the room, calm and majestic, except that there was a wrathful wrinkle on her rather prominent marble brow. With her imperturbable calm, she did not begin to speak in front of the valet. She knew of the duel and had come to speak about it. She waited till the valet had set down the coffee things and left the room. Pierre looked at her timidly over his spectacles, and like a hare surrounded by hounds who lays back her ears and continues to crouch motionless before her enemies, he tried to continue reading. But feeling this to be senseless and impossible, he again glanced timidly at her. She did not sit down, but looked at him with a contemptuous smile, waiting for the valet to go.
"Well, what's this now? What have you been up to now, I should like to know?"
she asked sternly.
"I? What have I?" stammered Pierre. "So, it seems you're a hero, eh? Come now, what was this duel about? What is it meant to prove? What, I ask you?"
Pierre turned over heavily on the ottoman and opened his mouth, but could not reply.
"If you won't answer, I'll tell you," Hélène went on. "You believe everything you're told. You were told," Hélène laughed, "that Dolokhov was my lover," she said in French, with her coarse plainness of speech, uttering the word amant as casually as any other word. "And you believed it. Well, What have you proved? What does this duel prove? That you're a fool? Que vous êtes un sot? But everybody knew that. What will be the result? That I shall be the laughingstock of all Moscow. That everyone will say that you, drunk and not knowing what you are about, challenged a man you are jealous of without cause. Hélène raised her voice and became more and more excited. A man who's a better man than you in every way. Growled Pierre, frowning without looking at her and not moving a muscle. And how could you believe he was my lover? Why? Because I like his company? If you were cleverer and more agreeable, I should prefer yours. Don't speak to me. I beg of you, muttered Pierre hoarsely. Why shouldn't I speak? I can speak as I like, and I tell you plainly that there are not many wives with husbands such as you who would not have taken lovers, but I have not done so, said she. Pierre wished to say something, looked at her with eyes whose strange expression she did not understand, and lay down again. He was suffering physically at that moment. There was a weight on his chest, and he could not breathe. He knew that he must do something to put an end to this suffering, but what he wanted to do was too terrible. "We had better separate," he muttered in a broken voice. "Separate? Very well, but only if you give me a fortune," said Hélène. "Separate? That's the thing to frighten me with." Pierre leapt up from the sofa and rushed staggering toward her. "I'll kill you!" he shouted, and seizing the marble top of a table with a strength he had never before felt, he made a step toward her, brandishing the slab. Hélène's face became terrible. She shrieked and sprang aside. His father's nature showed itself in Pierre. He felt the fascination and delight of frenzy. He flung down the slab, broke it, and swooping down on her with outstretched hands, shouted, "Get out!" in such a terrible voice that the whole house heard it with horror. God knows what he would have done at that moment had Hélène not fled from the room. A week later, Pierre gave his wife full power to control all his estates in Great Russia, which formed the larger part of his property, and left for Petersburg alone. Chapter 7. Bald Hills. News of Andrei missing. 2 months had elapsed since the news of the Battle of Austerlitz and the loss of Prince Andrei had reached Bald Hills, and in spite of the letters sent through the embassy and all the searches made, his body had not been found, nor was he on the list of prisoners. What was worst of all for his relations was the fact that there was still a possibility of his having been picked up on the battlefield by the people of the place, and that he might now be lying, recovering or dying, alone among strangers, and unable to send news of himself. The gazettes from which the old prince first heard of the defeat at Austerlitz stated, as usual very briefly and vaguely, that after brilliant engagements the Russians had had to retreat and had made their withdrawal in perfect order. The old prince understood from this official report that our army had been defeated. A week after the gazette report of the Battle of Austerlitz came a letter from Kutuzov informing the prince of the fate that had befallen his son. "Your son," wrote Kutuzov, "fell before my eyes, a standard in his hand and at the head of a regiment. He fell as a hero, worthy of his father and his fatherland. To the great regret of myself and of the whole army, it is still uncertain whether he is alive or not. I comfort myself and you with the hope that your son is alive, for otherwise he would have been mentioned among the officers found on the field of battle, a list of whom has been sent me under flag of truce." After receiving this news late in the evening, when he was alone in his study, the old prince went for his walk as usual next morning, but he was silent with his steward, the gardener, and the architect, and though he looked very grim, he said nothing to anyone. When Princess Maria went to him at the usual hour, he was working at his lathe and, as usual, did not look round at her.
"Ah, Princess Maria,"
he said suddenly, in an unnatural voice, throwing down his chisel. The wheel continued to revolve by its own impetus, and Princess Maria long remembered the dying creak of that wheel, which merged in her memory with what followed.
She approached him, saw his face, and something gave way within her. Her eyes grew dim. By the expression of her father's face, not sad, not crushed, but angry and working unnaturally, she saw that hanging over her and about to crush her was some terrible misfortune, the worst in life, one she had not yet experienced, irreparable and incomprehensible, the death of one she loved.
"Father, André,"
said the ungraceful, awkward princess with such an indescribable charm of sorrow and self-forgetfulness that her father could not bear to look but turned away with a sob.
"Bad news! He's not among the prisoners, nor among the killed. Kutuzov writes."
And he screamed as piercingly as if he wished to drive the princess away by that scream.
"Killed!"
The princess did not fall down or faint. She was already pale, but on hearing these words her face changed and something brightened in her beautiful, radiant eyes. It was as if joy, a supreme joy apart from the joys and sorrows of this world, overflowed the great grief within her. She forgot all fear of her father, went up to him, took his hand, and drawing him down, put her arm round his thin, scraggy neck.
"Father," she said, "do not turn away from me. Let us weep together."
"Scoundrels! Blackguards!"
shrieked the old man, turning his face away from her.
"Destroying the army! Destroying the men! And why? Go! Go and tell Lisa!"
The princess sank helplessly into an armchair beside her father and wept. She saw her brother now as he had been at the moment when he took leave of her and of Lisa, his look tender yet proud. She saw him tender and amused as he was when he put on the little icon. Did he believe? Had he repented of his unbelief? Was he now there? There in the realms of eternal peace and blessedness, she thought.
"Father, tell me how it happened," she asked through her tears.
"Go, go! Killed in battle, where the best of Russian men and Russia's glory were led to destruction! Go, Princess Maria! Go and tell Lisa! I will follow."
When Princess Maria returned from her father, the little princess sat working and looked up with that curious expression of inner, happy calm peculiar to pregnant women. It was evident that her eyes did not see Princess Maria, but were looking within, into herself, at something joyful and mysterious taking place within her.
"Maria,"
she said, moving away from the embroidery frame and lying back,
"give me your hand."
She took her sister-in-law's hand and held it below her waist. Her eyes were smiling expectantly. Her downy lip rose and remained lifted in childlike happiness. Princess Maria knelt down before her and hid her face in the folds of her sister-in-law's dress.
"There, there, do you feel it? I feel so strange. And do you know, Maria, I'm going to love him very much," said Lisa, looking with bright and happy eyes at her sister-in-law.
Princess Maria could not lift her head. She was weeping.
"What is the matter, Maria?" "Nothing, only I feel sad, sad about André," she said, wiping away her tears on her sister-in-law's knee.
Several times in the course of the morning, Princess Maria began trying to prepare her sister-in-law, and every time began to cry. Unobservant as was the little princess, these tears, the cause of which she did not understand, agitated her. She said nothing, but looked about uneasily as if in search of something. Before dinner, the old prince, of whom she was always afraid, came into her room with a peculiarly restless and malign expression and went out again without saying a word. She looked at Princess Maria, then sat thinking for a while with that expression of attention to something within her that is only seen in pregnant women, and suddenly began to cry.
"Has anything come from André?" she asked.
"No. You know it's too soon for news.
But my father is anxious, and I feel afraid. So, there's nothing?
Nothing, answered Princess Maria, looking firmly with her radiant eyes at her sister-in-law.